From the Danker Studio on Library Square, this is The Rundown, a live exploration of local news, current events, and issues that matter to you. Coming up on the program, Salt Lake County District Attorney Sim Gill on the legislature's investigation of the Attorney General and on alternative approaches in the criminal justice system.
We jail more human beings in the United States of America than any other country in the world. U.S. is number one, China is number two, Russia is number three, and Cuba is number four. And I'm not talking about some prorated number, I'm talking about a net body count. So we actually have probably one-fifth or one-fourth of the population of China, but we incarcerate far more people than they do.
Also, the Utah League of Women Voters gives a preview of tomorrow's interim session of the legislature and a local news summary. All that just ahead on The Rundown from KCPW. And thanks again for joining us for The Rundown, a news and information show where we look at emerging stories, current events, politics, and ideas. Here on the program, you can hear conversations with local newsmakers, trailblazers, cultural entrepreneurs, and more. Coming up later in the program, a discussion with Salt Lake County District Attorney Sim Gill and his pursuit of something called therapeutic justice. But we begin today, as we will every day from here on out, with a summary of today's top local news stories. And first up, a Utah state lawmaker says it's time to end compulsory education. Republican Senator Aaron Osmond of South Jordan says the idea of forcing children to attend school is outdated and should be scrapped in favor of a system that encourages learning by choice. Osmond told the Deseret News that compulsory education laws have resulted in parents disengaging themselves from the responsibility of overseeing the education of their children. He says that in many cases, teachers have been forced to become surrogate parents, expected to do everything from behavioral counseling to providing adequate nutrition. Osmond says that there needs to be a cultural shift so that children want to learn instead of having to learn. In other news, Representative Mike Noel is defending a state law that strips federal officers of police powers in Utah. Governor Gary Herbert is asking lawmakers to repeal the law. He put the request on an agenda for a special session Wednesday of the state legislature. The governor's office says it was Noel who asked for the repeal. But the Kanab Republican tells the Associated Press he didn't agree to repeal his measure. Noel declined to further comment until the legislature takes up the debate on Wednesday. The governor's deputy chief of staff, Ali Issam, told the Associated Press on Monday that the request for repeal came from Noel. Issam didn't respond Tuesday to a question about Noel's denial. The federal government is waging a successful battle to overturn the state law in court, where a judge issued an injunction to stop it from taking effect. And for decades, peregrine falcons, taking to a designated nesting box in downtown Salt Lake City, have taken some losses. Some eggs fail to hatch, and some hatchlings die testing out their wings. This year, however, has been a complete disaster. Only one of four eggs hatched in the nest box high on the former Hotel Utah building. And the survivor has been lost to a flying accident. The Utah Division of Wildlife Resources says the peregrine fledgling Solo sustained a spinal cord injury after slamming into a wall of glass at the nearby Zions Bank Tower. The Salt Lake Tribune reports that the hatchling died 10 days later at a rehabilitation facility. A caregiver says the bird had head trauma and was paralyzed in both legs, and finally died on July 3rd. Nesting falcons have been a Salt Lake tradition since 1986, with a webcast in Better Years showing eggs hatch and young birds flapping their wings for weeks before their first takeoff. And Utah is number one again in a list of pro-business states, according to an independent report from Polina Corporate Real Estate. Ali Issam, the deputy chief of staff for Gary Herbert, says the report reflects how well Utah is doing compared to other states.
The governor in particular was impressed by the fact that Utah isn't just leading by a narrow margin. We are leading by a lot. Last year, we had an 11-point lead over the second-ranked Virginia. This year, our lead is 26 points ahead of number two, Nebraska, because we continually improve our business climate and we focus on those things that matter most to grow jobs.
Issam says the state is seeing steady increases in key economic indicators, such as the job growth rate, which is at 2.6% in Utah, twice the national average, as well as unemployment, which is at 4.6%, 3 points lower than the national rate. She expects Utah will stay on top with investments being made in science, technology, engineering, and math education, which will help create jobs in the future.
We are investing in the right sectors in our education system to help dovetail with the needs of future employers in the state of Utah.
In 2005, Utah ranked 23rd and made big jumps over the years to achieve the number one position in 2012 and 2013. That's today's local news summary. I'm Roger McDonough, and you're listening to The Rundown here on KCPW. We'll be right back. Now on the program, we get a preview of what's expected to be a big day at the Utah State Legislature tomorrow from Nancy Melling of the Utah League of Women Voters.
Good afternoon, Roger. Tomorrow is interim committee day at the legislature. Committees meet from 9 a.m. to noon and from 2:30 to 5 p.m. to explore issues and propose legislation. At 12:30, all legislators gather for a special session on the House floor. They'll consider reversing a law passed last session that said federal officers couldn't enforce state laws on federal land, which is likely unconstitutional. They also want to nail down details of their investigation of Attorney General John Swallow, including how open their meetings would be. Swallow has been accused of promising or delivering special favors in exchange for large campaign contributions. In morning committees, government operations will discuss one of the bills before the special session, Legislative Investigative Committee amendments. Two other bills, HB 410 and HB 311, would limit individual campaign contributions to $10,000 for state, legislative, state school board, and judicial candidates. Utah is one of only four states with no limits on contribution amounts at all. Limits have been proposed over the years, mostly by Governor Huntsman and a special commission on good government. But so far, legislators have insisted that large contributions don't influence them. The Education Committee will hear the state school board's goals for higher and public education, plus a description from a panel of school teachers of the elements that they think contribute to high student achievement. Public Utilities and Technology will talk about competitiveness of rural telephone servers and about natural gas infrastructure, including extending gas lines in rural areas and the effect of interstate gas transmission lines on Utah's economy. Health and Human Service deliberations will address the state's Medicaid preferred drug list, calculating drug manufacturer rebates, and why brand name drugs are sometimes given preference over generics. Implementation of the state plan for Alzheimer's disease and updates on state and federal health reform, including Medicaid expansion, are scheduled, plus a sunset review of the health care compact among states who want health care to be a state, not federal responsibility. In afternoon committees, Economic Development and Workforce Services will hear a business leader panel describe what they want in an educated workforce. Law Enforcement and Criminal Justice will hear about an interagency strike force to combat illegal immigration and human trafficking, and how criminal fines are being used to fund law enforcement drug operations. Natural Resources, Agriculture, and Environment will review Utah's energy policy and the humane treatment, slaughter, and disposal of domestic animals, horses in particular. A sunset review of Utah's Air Conservation Act and reports on rural water pollution reduction are also scheduled. In transportation, the UTA will report on its responsibilities and funding. The state's Unified Transportation Plan for metropolitan areas, including how transportation projects are chosen and prioritized, and Utah's eligibility for federal transportation funding will be discussed as well. Join the League at the Legislature. Watch, listen, or contact your legislator online at Utah's legislative website, le.utah.gov. And for more information, visit the League at the League of Women Voters at lwvutah.org on Facebook and Twitter.
Nancy, thanks very much for this preview.
Thanks, Roger.
That's Nancy Melling of the Utah League of Women Voters. Now on The Rundown, we turn to our discussion with Salt Lake County District Attorney Sim Gill. Gill was elected to that position in 2010, and since that time has devoted much of his energy to implementing various so-called therapeutic justice programs. I asked the DA about these programs and also about some ongoing cases his office is looking into. Thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
So what are your thoughts, District Attorney Gill, on the decision by the state legislature to investigate Attorney General John Swallow? This is one of the things I want to get out of the way sort of at the first of our interview.
Well, you know, it's an independent political body, and they have their charge and their responsibilities and everything that I've seen and observed. I think they're trying to approach this very carefully and very diligently. They need to be commended on the thoroughness with which this very complex debate is taking place. But their charge is fundamentally different from the stuff that myself and Mr. Rawlings are doing within the context of state issues and whatever the federal agencies may be doing in the context of that. Criminal investigations are fundamentally different than the sort of the process that the legislature is engaged in. But from everything that I've seen, I know that everybody is trying to be extremely sensitive, take this with the seriousness that it deserves, and I think that everybody's trying to be very thorough. So I think they have their job to do, we have our job to do, and they just need to be commended for the sensitivity that they displayed and the thoroughness that they're trying to exercise.
I know that in the statement that you and
Troy
Rawlings released, you said that accusations don't amount to criminal wrongdoing.
No, and I think that's absolutely important. You know, there's a lot of emotion involved in this. There's a lot of speculation involved in this. I think it's absolutely important to recognize two things. One, there is the presumption of innocence, which is afforded to everyone under our system, to every citizen. Mr. Swallow and anybody else who would be involved is entitled to that as well. That presumption of innocence. The other thing is that mere allegations do not equate to criminal wrongdoing. They are just that. They're allegations. The beauty of our system is that when it is objective and transparent, that we can go ahead with the checks and balances that we have, engage in those investigations, and then we have standards and protocols by which to make those evaluative judgments from. And so mere allegations are not a sufficient basis to conclude that there is criminal wrongdoing, absolutely. And I think that's a very important presumptions and observations that we have to acknowledge in any criminal investigation, and this one in particular.
And yours and Troy Rawlings' offices are both assisting in the state and federal investigations? Is that the idea?
Well, we are working our interest comes in a sort of a parallel, but also a joint work that we're overlapping things that we're looking at for state violation and potential state violation. That's within our jurisdiction. And of course, the federal authorities have their jurisdictions, and just like the legislature has their jurisdiction.
So I'm going to move on to another topic. We spoke some time ago about something that really only got a minor media blip, which was this the alleged forged signature of Justice Christine Durham on a petition packet for election reform, which was tied to a computer at the state capitol while the legislature was in session. Are there any updates on this case that you can give me or anything you can say about it?
Well, that is something that, we've acknowledged that is something that my office is looking into, and we're working with both state and federal authorities on that. And that continues to be an open investigation. The allegations are very serious and concerning. And regardless of what happens, I think a thorough examination of what transpired is good for the process as well as for the public trust. And so we're still engaged in that, and that's about all I can say at this time.
Then we'll move on to another topic, which is you guys had dropped a large number of West Valley City narcotics cases. And I don't want to dredge up old stories here, but can the public have renewed faith in the West Valley City Police Department, or what's going on with your investigation?
Sure. Well, first of all, I've said this many times, and let me start this conversation by underscoring this once again. There are an incredible number of good men and women in law enforcement in West Valley who do their job honorably, professionally, ethically, that the citizens of West Valley can absolutely trust. And the conduct of one or some officers should not be a commentary or a judgment on the otherwise good actions of the rest of those police officers who are daily working and putting their life in harm's way. Now, having said that, that is something that our office has been involved in. There are basically three sort of silos of issues that are separate but overlapping in some respects. So let me identify those for you. The first silo is the investigation pertaining to the use of force involving the death of Danielle Willard in that officer-involved shooting. That is one separate issue. West Valley engaged in a very thorough and long investigation. That investigation has been turned over to my office. My office has met with them and gone through the materials, and we are sifting through, and now we're towards the tail end of our analysis, and in the very near future we'll be bringing that to a conclusion based on all the information, the investigation that's been done, and that is separate and distinct from the other two issues. So the first issue is the use of force justified, and that's what we're looking at. And the way it works under our system If the use of force is justified, then that issue is moot and it's closed. If that, if the finding is that that use of force is not justified, then it would start a second inquiry, which is then if that use of force is not justified, does it warrant the filing of criminal charges, and what is the proof level, what is the evidence to do that, and that's a separate inquiry. So we're still engaged in that first silo.
Can I remind just the fact that this is a case in which officers fired on a woman who was alleged to have just purchased drugs and backed out using her car. She was trying to get away or maybe ran into one of the officers.
Again,
that's the allegations.
Those are the allegations, yeah. And so yes, this involved a allegation of a drug purchase and the law enforcement contact that occurred, and then the ensuing unfolding of events, and what was the nature of that contact, what was the ensuing unfolding, and the issues that are revolving around that.
I got this. So we can move to the second.
And so the second issue is that out of that first shoot that occurred, that incident occurred in November, there were some issues that were discovered with one of the officers that raised some concerns about certain evidence and the handling of that evidence, which led to some further inquiries and subsequently raised a second silo of concern for us, which was the potential criminality of one of the officers involved in that shoot, and which are separate from the shoot itself. And so in that issue, my office has been working with, with the FBI, and just like we were in the first one as well. And let me just sort of say, the role of the FBI in the first one was to the issue, very narrow issue in the shoot, which was to focus on any issues pertaining to that relating to conspiracy, cover-ups, or any kind of collusion. So their role has been very narrow in that. Their role has not been on the ultimate analysis of the justification. So just want to be very clear.
Right.
The FBI has been assisting in this second issue, along with Salt Lake City Police Department, in investigating any specific criminality or criminal conduct on one of the officers as it pertained to the things that we discovered, some of the inquiry that started from the shooting itself. That is a separate issue as a focus. Now, what that did was, as a result of that investigation, it brought into light some other issues which led to the dismissal of some cases. And so the things that we discovered in that second criminal investigation gave us concern as public prosecutors, because what happens is that we have an ongoing affirmative duty under the Constitution that when we become aware of certain kinds of facts or certain realities, that that information then has to be communicated to defense counsel under our system of law. So as we looked at it, and it raised some concern about the confidence with which we could move forward and the quality of the evidence if it was compromise, and that led to the dismissal of a first batch of charges that involved certain officers.
I know your time is limited, and I just want to get one question in there, which are you said that there were certain things that you guys had discovered that led you to lose confidence and then to invest to carry out another investigation. Can I ask just sort of specifically what some of those things were?
Well, I can't go into details beyond saying that they certainly impacted the veracity of the evidence, the quality and the truthfulness of the evidence, which greatly compromised our ability to prosecute successfully. And when we as a prosecutors are aware of that, we don't get to bury our head in the sand. We have actually an affirmative obligation. And that finding then led to a broader issue, which is the third silo, it was this issue limited to just these two officers who were involved in the shoot, or did that also implicate other members of this neighborhood narcotics unit? And subsequently, as we looked into it, there were some overlapping in different capacities, some of those same Brady Giglio veracity issues, which then led to a second round of dismissals, which were, of course, then also followed by a dismissals that occurred by the U.S. Attorney's Office in federal court as well. So in essence, what you have is those three silos of investigations that are going on. And the FBI has been assisting in different capacities in each one of those investigations, as well as other independent investigation agencies. So that really sort of lays out the complexity and the nuance of what has been transpiring here. And I think it's also important to recognize that, my office found, and nobody who was was associated with law enforcement found any pleasure in dismissing any of those cases, but we needed to dismiss those cases in order to maintain the public trust, to maintain the integrity of other cases that were going to be prosecuted, because we needed to be able to say, yes, we did the affirmatively right thing to do that needed to be done, so we could maintain the integrity of other cases that were currently being prosecuted by West Valley Police Agency as well.
So, District Attorney Gill, I'm going to move away from what we've been speaking about and ask you sort of more on the policy level. You've been a big proponent of something called therapeutic justice programs. What are these programs?
Well, look, here's the basic reality that everybody sort of intuitively knows, but let's go ahead and put it out in the open anyways. In the United States of America, there was a paper that was done by the Pew Charitable Trust a few years ago that identified that we jail more human beings in the United States of America than any other country in the world. U.S. is number one, China is number two, Russia is number three, and Cuba is number four. And I'm not talking about some prorated number, I'm talking about a net body count. So we actually have probably one-fifth or one-fourth of the population of China, but we incarcerate far more people and than they do. And the challenge is that under our current criminal justice system, the costs are escalating. The recidivism rates are not being impacted. We're not getting for the return on investment on that we're obligated to make into the in the institution of criminal justice. So one of the things that we had to start looking at is that there had to be a better way. And what would that better way look like? So it needed to be supported by data-driven, research-based best practices. And we need to start looking at to see who was being jailed. Look, I'm a public prosecutor, and if you commit a violent crime and you're a risk to my community, I am going to prosecute you, I'm going to lock you up, and I'm going to ask to throw the key away. But we need to make sure that people who were mentally ill or people who were drug addicts were not simply being incarcerated with the same rate as the people who are rapists and murderers. And so we should be locking up people that we are afraid of who are a risk to our community rather than everybody else who we may dislike. So the therapeutic justice model really says is, look, if we can transition these folks out of the criminal justice system, get them the medical support or the therapeutic support that's necessary and get better returns on an investment, then we should follow that. So for example, drug court's an example of that. Mental health court, which I helped start over 12 years ago, is an example of that. Take, for example, mental health court. For that population, we have reduced recidivism rates from 68% down to 19%, and we are also getting a better return on investment. So when we looked at the same control population when we did the study, over a 7-year period, they would have used over 77,000 jail days. But the same group under a mental health therapeutic justice model used, I think, approximately about 7,000 or 8,000 days. The same group would have institutionally cost over $6.5 million conservatively, and we were able to address the needs of them for about $600,000. So that is the value of therapeutic justice. It means that we are providing the return on investment to taxpayers that they deserve, and not locking everybody up because we can, but we should be only locking up those that continue to pose an immediate risk of safety and concern, and those who are the serious crime.
So 12 years ago was the mental health program. How about some of these other programs? How long have they been around?
Well, drug court has been around for a long time. I would say almost 15 years or so now going on. Mental health court's been around for the last 12 years. We're also, big advocates of a family justice center approach, which is looking at the crimes against victims of domestic violence. And we're realizing that we need to create a structure where we make the victim feel safe and secure, get the therapeutic support, the transitional housing, the workforce services, and wrap those services around a victim, and then that victim is more likely to participate in the subsequent prosecution of the offender. But those are the kind of different innovative ways, thinking out of the box, that we need in order to make the next evolution in criminal justice. Because if we don't do that, well, here's the reality that we do know. We, from the mid-70s, we went from spending about $6 billion a year nationally to an excess basis of $60 billion a year nationally on our infrastructure of criminal justice. Two-thirds of the people who come out of prison are going to be back in prison within 36 months. And so we are spending billions of dollars, and we're not getting a return on investment. And so what are we going to do with these individuals when they come back into our community if you don't understand their therapeutic needs? And for if you're going to just do a cold fiscal analysis, get a better return of investment for the taxpayers, and while you can still impact recidivism rates. So data-based, research-based methodologies of addressing the underlying core issues of why people are engaged in this criminal behavior.
So why then? I'm just curious. There must be critics to this approach. There are people who, you know, you got to get tough on crime, and that's the only thing.
Absolutely. And, you know, the first emotional reaction is this idea that you're being soft on crime, or somehow we're going to be tough. We're not being tough on crime. And look, don't take my word for it. Look at what's happening in Texas. Look what is happening in Georgia. Look what's happening in South Dakota and Wisconsin and Washington and these different states. And what they're realizing is that fiscally speaking, they cannot afford to not introduce therapeutic justice in the process. The other thing is, if you lock everybody up, then what you're doing is you're creating a systemic bloat, and this systemic bloat starts to chip away at your ability to be effective against those tough crimes that you want to prosecute. The murderers, the rapists, the child molesters, those are the ones that then all co-mingle with the rest volume of these other cases. So systemically, it weighs it down. So what we're saying is, it's not about being soft on crime, it's rather being smart on crime. We want to target our resources for those crimes that are a concern to our community, and we want to aggressively prosecute those and hold those offenders accountable. You know, I asked this question once. I said, look, we may come from different political agendas, we may come from different philosophical leanings, but and we may all disagree upon what the right answer is, but we will not disagree upon what the right answer will look like. So for example, the right answer can't cost us more than our current model is costing. It should cost us less. The right answer should not compromise on traditional law enforcement values and objectives. The right answer should give us better measurable outcomes which can be replicated in an objective and transparent way so they can be research-based and be data-driven. And so everybody, both people on the left, people on the right, fiscal conservatives, everybody agrees, yes, that's what the right answer would look like. Well, mental health court, drug court, other therapeutic justice model programs are doing exactly that. So for example, over 2 years ago, we started the very first early case resolution model, which said that, look, instead of having people sit in this bloated system in an elongated way of 6 to 7 months before we adjudicate their system case, what if we took certain number of cases, the low-hanging fruit, if you will, in the criminal justice system, and we resolve them within a 30-day period? Could that be done? And the early case resolution has demonstrated a resolution rate of over 43% net cases in third district court. And those cases, once you reduce the calendar, and I've always said this, your caseloads will go down, but your workloads will go up because now you have the time to spend, more time to spend, on those really important cases. So in fact, you're actually becoming more effective on the serious crime. So this is not being soft on crime. This is about being smart on crime and then giving the level of measure of justice and safety to our community that they deserve and expect, rather than the rhetoric of a bloated and antiquated model that is non-responsive to those needs but only gives lip service to our citizens.
We've gone well over the time that we have allotted, but I want to say thanks for taking the time to speak with us and for talking about some of these results that you've had with therapeutic justice, as well as with your ongoing investigations. It's been interesting.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for the privilege.
That was Salt Lake County District Attorney Sim Gill. A full version of this interview can be found at our website, kcpw.org. Tomorrow on the program, Zach Frankel of the Utah Rivers Council on projections that the state's water demand will exceed its supply if conservation efforts aren't implemented, and on the ongoing battle over plans to dam the Bear River. That and a daily summary of local news tomorrow at 5 on The Rundown, here on KCPW. Thanks for joining us today for The Rundown from KCPW. Our program today was produced by Lauren Colucci. We had additional help from Jesse Ellis and Mr. Tyler Ford. Our theme music was composed by Tim Myers. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for joining us. The Utah Business Report and Marketplace are coming up next. Stay tuned.